The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Now we step into the lunchtime doctor with Dr. Dean and Dr.
Michael.
I don't want to call the wrong name. But welcome to the show, lady and gent. And today I understand that we'll be debunking medical myths.
Yes. So today is going to be a very interactive show. So we are going to be debunking some medical myths. And of course, we want to encourage the listeners to call in, you know, ask us about your medical myths, something that you may know or are unsure of, and see if we can debunk them for you. So yes, Tuska will give you guys the numbers.
Phone numbers. The numbers are 627-3223, 625-2257, and of course, 306-1065.
Mm-hmm. So we have Dr. Mike from the Doctor's Journal with us here today, and he will be helping us debunk some of these medical myths. So how are you doing, Dr. Mike?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Of course, of course. And is there anything you want to start with in particular? Any pressing myths that you have that you want to debunk for our listeners here today?
Well, I think that one of the most basic myths, or the most common myths that people have, is that they, for example, are prescribed antibiotics for 5 days or 7 days, let's say for the cold or for a urinary tract infection. And by day two, their symptoms are gone, they are feeling better, and that's it. I only took 2 days of medication and now I am okay. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that is an incomplete course of antibiotics. And the problems that arise with that are many. One could be that the infection is not appropriately treated, which means it will recur. So you have not destroyed all the bacteria that are causing whichever infection it is. Therefore, there's a high chance of recurrence. Added to that, aside from the recurrence, now the bacteria has gotten a taste of this antibiotic. So he says, well, you know what? I want to become stronger.
Resistance.
Yeah.
Yes.
So now we have what you call antibiotic resistance. So then you can give the same antibiotic for the infection and then it's not as effective.
Right. So you're going to have to start them on a new course of antibiotics. And at this point, you know, the infection may become more severe to the point where some people even get septic if they don't take their full course of antibiotics.
Exactly.
So this myth would be, you know, some people think you should stop taking your antibiotics once you get better, but that's not the case. You should take your full prescribed course of antibiotics. You know, once it's prescribed by a doctor, it's prescribed for a particular reason. So you need to be compliant with the amount of days that you have to take, as well as the same dosages that the doctor has prescribed for you, so that the bacteria can be completely eradicated, so that you don't get, you know, a severe course of this infection or antibiotic resistance.
Well, just on this course of thought, the tablets that you don't take, some people save them for another time. So you have to address that as well.
Yes.
You know, saving of tablets, the ones that you don't finish from the course of many. Is that in the cupboard? You could use that there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, right. So it's the same thing, because the same issue will arise again, right? So now, okay, it took 2 out of 5 days. So you say, okay, you have 3 days. So next time, you're gonna do the same thing, maybe two, you might need three.
Yeah.
And then, okay, but you still have to go back to the doctor if it happens again and get another course again. So now you have actually done yourself a disservice, right? Because you haven't cleared up the infection appropriately or properly. And now there's a high chance and high risk that the infection can recur again in the exact same place. So this is why I have people with recurrent UTIs or recurrent lung infection. This is just one of the reasons. And downstream, we are seeing a thing called multi-drug resistant organisms. This is when patients are taking short course of antibiotics. They are taking the wrong antibiotics for the prescribed drug, which means i.e. they're going on their own and saying to whichever person, I need to get X drug for this infection, you know. So now they are their own doctor. So now we have downstream effects where we have severe infections that could result in sepsis and even death, you know, and infections can happen anywhere, brain, heart, kidney, lung, anywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I agree with that. I feel like, you know, there are people, and I know, like, sometimes it's in the older generation, they tend to save all these medications in the medication cabinet and think that they can take it for another day. But like we were saying before, you know, you can have drug resistance building up. So the next time, that drug may not even work for this infection.
Yeah.
So that is a big thing that, you know, we need to address. And compliance is very important when it comes to any type of medication. You know, even if it's your medication for diabetes, your medication for high blood pressure, compliance is extremely, extremely important. Right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we touched a good bits on this particular one. So another myth that we want to talk about is, you know, I have a lot of patients that come in and, you know, they probably would have had a heart attack before and they're placed on something called blood thinners, right? And a lot of patients tend to think that blood thinners make you bleed excessively. Now, Dr. Taylor, you want to debunk this for us, or maybe put it in a way that people can understand, you know, what blood thinners do and the benefit to risk in terms of certain diseases?
Excellent. Now, the reason for blood thinners when somebody has had a heart attack is because the vessel or the inside of the vessel may have become blocked, right? The aim of the blood thinners is to either alleviate the block or help prevent the blockage from getting worse, right? So it does this by thinning the blood, quote-unquote, where you actually have a decrease in the potential for clots to happen. Now, when you do this, yes, there's an increased risk of bleeding, right? But now we have to talk about the risk versus the benefit, right? Meaning the risk of bleeding is outweighed by the benefit of preventing a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
Heart attacks can be fatal, right? So anytime you recommend blood thinners, which have different strengths, right? So we have different types, and we have ones that are more potent than others. So usually patients with a heart attack are placed on two blood thinners, right? Which work synergistically together to prevent that clot from building up and to prevent another heart attack or stroke, etc. Now, we assess the risk for bleeding, meaning if you have had certain conditions that increase your risk for fetal bleeding, then we actually would be very cautious in giving that medication, and we may even only do one.
Yes, because I know that, you know, in the hospital, we weigh it based on certain scores.
Yeah.
And if you have certain risk factors, of course, we will not be giving you blood thinners if you have these risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, blood thinners can be used to treat certain diseases, like we're seeing heart attacks, strokes, things like that.
Yeah.
And of course, the benefits will outweigh the risks. There are certain conditions where we cannot use blood thinners. For example, if somebody is bleeding, you know, that's just going to make it worse. But for the average person, they should not be placed on blood thinners, right?
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people ask about aspirin in particular, because this does have that blood thinning effect, but some people would take it for their headaches, some people would take it for certain medical conditions as well. So on the use of aspirin.
So that's a very good question as well. Now, in terms of medication, right, we have different levels of treatment. We have preventative, and we have where we treat in something. So we have the event where we want to prevent something from happening, and then we have the event where somebody has had something happen already, and now we want to prevent it from them. So primary and secondary, right? So there is a role for aspirin in addition to other drugs, like things to control the cholesterol, in patients who have high risk factors for having heart attack and stroke, for example, somebody with diabetes and hypertension, you may want to place them on aspirin as preventative therapy for heart attack and stroke. So this is why, you know, people may say, well, so why am I on aspirin? That is probably the reason, if you have had nothing happen to you yet.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make it clear that, you know, certain medications, you need to go to your doctor before taking them. Your doctor has to outweigh the risks versus the benefits, so that for you particularly, for you as an individual, because everybody is different and everybody will have different risk factors. So, of course, you will need to go to your doctor, let them take a proper history and examine you appropriately, and then place you on the appropriate medical treatment. Now, as we're on the course of medication, you know, another myth that, you know, some people like to bring up is natural remedies are always safer because they're natural versus, you know, prescribed medication.
Yeah.
So what would we say in a situation like this?
That's a very good question. I think that there is a rule for natural remedies, right? And this rule is actually more in the preventative process.
Yes.
Right? When we start to look at, we actually manifest in disease, heart attack, stroke, etc., or whatever it is, now we have to reach a point where we say, you know what? We have not achieved the results that we wanted to achieve with natural remedies.
Yes.
And now we have to look at conventional therapy.
Yes, evidence-based medicine.
Yeah. Because, for example, if you have a burst appendix, right, you're not going to rely on natural remedies for this. This needs immediate opening of the belly by a surgeon. You understand? For example, another condition, aortic dissection, where you have a tear in the big artery of the heart. There's no natural remedy that could fix that. That needs immediate vascular intervention. Someone has to cut down the middle of the chest wall, go in and fix that immediately.
Yes, right. So I agree with you. I think that natural remedies can be beneficial. You know, for example, you know, when we were talking about sleep, you know, the chamomile tea, things like that, it will be beneficial in certain instances. But some of them also have side effects, and they can interact with medications that you are placed on as well. So even if you are taking your prescribed medication, some people may come back to the doctor and say, well, it's not working. And when we look deeper into your history, it's because you are taking something that is interacting with the medication that we are giving you. So there is a place for natural remedies in certain instances. But if you are placed on a certain medication, you need to be upfront with your doctor about other things that you're taking, and you also need to collaborate with your doctor, because you may need to, you know, cut back on the natural remedies when it comes to that time, and go with the evidence-based medicine, because that is what is going to help heal you or help, you know, decrease your symptoms, etc. So I would say that while there is a place for natural remedies, you still need to consult with your doctor. Not everything can be treated with natural remedies. Right?
Of course, folks, you listen to the Lunchtime Doctor. And just last week, I had this discussion with our doctor that does the diabetes and you, because I saw him on the news, and they were trying to, you know, we'll say these natural remedy so-called doctors, you know, they call them the herbal, herbal doctors, you know, are no good. But if you take it back to our grandmother, I'm sure you all, your grandma, nowadays there were certain medicines that, you know, seem to work. I don't know if it's a mind over matter thing, you know, but no, but I mean, it's not every and everything you could take a herbal medicine for, but there are some things that some people do live and swear by. So where is the borderline, you as doctors, and these sort of herbs? Because they do even say some of these, the medicines that we take are, you know, made out of herbs. So where's the, where do you draw the line?
Yeah, so essentially, that's a very good observation. You know, so what I would say is a few things. One, we have science now, which means we have dose-measured responses to drugs, which means if I give 81 milligrams of this drug, I can predict the effect. When it comes to natural remedies, we tend to become more obscure, because now we are not sure how much of this specific medication or plant is going to yield X benefit.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So that is one. So now the inaccuracy of it comes into play. That is why in terms of prevention or when you are healthy, it's more acceptable. Mm-hmm. But when you start to have a disease process happening, you want specific goals met. You have targets. You want to meet your objectives. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know?
And what I would add to that as well is that there are certain treatments that some people may be taking for certain ailments. For example, I would say something like turmeric or saffron.
Yeah.
You know, it helps with infection, etc. Mm-hmm. And some women may be taking it for that mm-hmm. reason.
Right.
But then they get other effects from it, something mm-hmm. called menorrhagia, where you're bleeding excessively.
Mm-hmm.
And we've actually found that this causes your blood to thin a little bit and mm-hmm. makes you bleed a little more during your period.
Mm-hmm.
So you will get other side effects, even though you're using it to treat one specific ailment.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of things that are not studied
yeah.
with natural remedies, so we will not know the exact effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would say is that, of course, there are certain diseases that can be treated by natural remedies or certain conditions.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the hospital, we would use in diabetic patients' feet, mm-hmm. we would use green pawpaw because it has something, like it has an ingredient in it that helps with healing or mm-hmm. wound healing. And honey as well,
yeah,
it helps with,
honey.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it helps with wound healing.
So doctors are not totally against the natural.
No, not totally against it.
Some people may seem to think the doctors hate the natural.
That's not the truth.
I think the issue is where patients tend to just rely solely on the natural
yes.
for a medical condition
mm-hmm.
and then they don't get the results that they want
mm-hmm.
and now they get more harm long term.
Yeah. What about like religious purposes where there are some religions mm-hmm. that would not take certain medications even in terms of blood transfusions?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you deal with that?
What happens is that there's a certain religion, you know, that we, and that is why we ask religion in the hospital, because there are certain religions that don't take blood transfusions. And what we would do for these patients would be, you know, we would give them byproducts of blood so that they can still get the effects of a blood transfusion without actually having a blood transfusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But of course, you know, blood transfusions are more beneficial, but in these certain patients, we can't be giving them, you know, blood transfusions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, of course, coming up in just a short while, we'll be having an interview. We'll be talking to our optometrist again at Dalton Brong. In the meantime, you can lean into a healthier life with GNC Total Lean, where actual science meets tasty flavors to make your wellness journey fun, delicious, and way more convenient. GNC Total Lean is a complete brand of weight management supplements, total lean meal replacements, and snacks. Not only can the high-quality products help you in your weight management journey, but they're also great solutions for living an overall healthier lifestyle. Available at GNC stores, supermarkets, and pharmacies nationwide. Visit GNCTT on Instagram for more information. GNC, live well. Also, LSA Healthcare Services Limited is commercial hygiene service provider with 20 years of experience in the industry. LSA's goal is to change the culture of hygiene by educating their clients about hygiene solutions for all spaces. Hygiene is essential for all organization, staff, and customers' well-being. It is your business committed to high standards of hygiene. Check them out on the latest innovation in hands-free sanitary bins, hand-washing solutions, odor control systems, hand towel and jumbo toilet paper dispensers, sanitization dispensers, janitorial cleaning, and fogging sanitization. Contact LSA Healthcare at 675-3466 for a free assessment. Visit their website at lsahealthcare.com and social media pages on Facebook, IG, and LinkedIn. Right, LSA Healthcare Services Limited, your partner in hygiene solutions. Of course, our numbers, folks, are 627-3223, 625-2257, 306-1065. You can feel free to message us with any of your health issues as we return to Dr. Dean and Dr. Taylor.
Right, so we are debunking some medical myths here today. And another one that I want to bring up that is usually brought up, you know, sometimes during these segments, is taking vitamins and supplements can compensate for a poor diet. What is your take on this particular myth?
Mm-hmm. That's a very common myth. Now, to be honest, vitamin supplements can add to a well-balanced diet, mm-hmm. but in terms of compensating for a bad diet, no. You won't be able to achieve those results with vitamin supplements.
Mm-hmm. And I want to touch a little bit on the vegan diet. You know, would vitamins and supplements help in this case? For example, you know, vegans will not be able to get a lot of B12, mm-hmm. a lot of that lean protein that you will get from a balanced diet. Mm-hmm. A vegan diet, would they be able to get, you know, this... the supplementation that they need through vitamins?
Yeah, well, good question. Now, specifically, if you are lacking one or two micronutrients, mm-hmm. that is different, right? So essentially, they would be able to supplement with the B12 and folate and achieve good results,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to somebody who, you know, is deficient all across the board,
yes.
in different micronutrients. That will be a little more, it will be more difficult to replenish those stores, etc. They may need to even go to hospital,
mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah.
So, I mean, I agree with you as well. You know, while vitamins and supplements can complement a healthy diet, mm-hmm. it can't fully compensate for poor eating habits. So you need to prioritize a balanced diet full of fruits, vegetables, lean proteins, etc. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're a vegan, you need to compensate by taking your B12, your folate, etc.
I do have a question here. Mm-hmm. What is the truth concerning red wine being the only good for you alcohol? And does it help to reduce heart attack and stroke?
That's an excellent question. Now, long story short, the beneficial component in the red wine is some called resveratrol, but the amount, when they redid studies, the amount of red wine you need to consume to get a beneficial dose is extremely high. In terms of dealing with the cardiovascular risk profile, the studies are showing that it's probably better to not drink at all.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you are consuming alcohol, etc., okay, try to limit it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that is the best approach.
Right. And of course, I mean, there are studies that show that there is a little bit of a benefit to heart health mm-hmm. when it comes to red wine. Mm-hmm. You know, the resveratrol and other antioxidants in the red wine actually reduce inflammation. Mm-hmm. But like Dr. Taylor said, mm-hmm. when it comes to alcohol, it's best not to consume it. Mm-hmm. But if you are consuming alcohol, you know, red wine will have the antioxidants, the resveratrol, that actually has a little bit of benefits for you. But when it comes to consuming any type of alcohol, it's best to limit it to one glass per day, I think, for women.
In terms of red wine?
Yes, red wine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have another question here. How does green pawpaw help with a diabetic, and how do you use it?
Right. So that is I know somebody was going to ask about this. So in the hospital, sometimes we do ask patients to get green pawpaw to help with wound healing in diabetic wounds. So the green pawpaw actually contains certain enzymes, and the enzyme is called papain, if I'm not wrong, and it has anti-inflammatory and wound healing properties, and they help actually remove the dead tissue from the wound, and they promote healthy growth. They also have antioxidants in them, etc. So when we are addressing wounds in terms of diabetics in the hospital, we usually dress the wounds with the pawpaw. So we'd have the patient's family bring in like pawpaw that's been crushed up, the green pawpaw, and we would use it to dress. This is something that you need to consult your physician with. We only do this in the hospital
in certain cases.
So this is something that needs to be consulted with your doctor. And first of all, they will try certain things. When it comes to that point, then they may go for the more natural remedies to help with the wound healing or to accelerate the speed of the healing. So at that point, they would use the green pawpaw. They would use certain medications that contain honey or that's honey-based. But again, this is something that your physician needs to recommend for you. You can't just go and put something in your wound that you don't know about.
All right, definitely. Well, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be chatting with our friends at Dalton Brong, optometrist. All right, folks, we're back at you with the Lunchtime Doctor. And, of course, we have our optometrist from Dalton Brong, optometrist on the line. We say hello, good afternoon.
So today we actually wanted to talk about the OCT examination as part of the regular eye examination for our patients.
Yes. So I was going to ask you, what exactly is OCT? Because, you know, a lot of patients will come in and they will just hear about this OCT scan. Can you tell us what it stands for and how it works?
Yeah, so the OCT stands for optical coherence tomography. It's an actual exam that captures high resolution 3D cross-sectional images of the back of the eye, which is known as the retina. That is the tissue at the back of the eye, and also the optic nerve, which is the nerve that comes into the eye, enabling us to see. So this is an examination which is not an invasive examination, meaning that it's something like having a picture taken of the eye. So the patient isn't, it's not uncomfortable to have it done. It's an easy examination to do. And it takes on average about 10 or 15 minutes to actually complete the examination.
Okay, great. And what are the benefits of doing this? I know you said it's non-invasive, so that's a big benefit already. So what are other benefits of doing the OCT?
Well, the main benefit is actually the early detection of eye diseases. So especially in our patients who are over 50, you know, once we reach that age, we're more likely to have lifestyle diseases such as diabetes and hypertension, but also other eye diseases, which would be things like glaucoma and cataracts, even macular changes. These are conditions which can affect the eye, and there can be an early detection when you use the OCT scan. And this is the reason why we promote the OCT scan, because if these abnormalities are picked up early, then it's much easier to manage the disease.
Okay, great. And you said that it can help detect eye diseases. So can you tell us how it actually helps detect these eye diseases? And how would a patient know if they need to do an OCT examination?
Right. So that's a good question. How would the patient know? If the patient has a family history of any eye diseases, then they should definitely have an OCT scan. If they are diabetic or they have high blood pressure, then it is also very advantageous for them to do an OCT scan to see if there's any abnormality which have occurred in the eye due to these conditions.
Okay, great.
And what was the other question?
So how regularly should an OCT examination be done for certain patients?
Well, usually it depends on the actual issue that they might have, that it may present with the symptoms or so. Then annually would be the best time for them to have that examination done. But for example, patients that might have been diagnosed with glaucoma, they may do it at least routinely every 6 to 12 months.
Okay, great. And how can somebody schedule an appointment to do an OCT examination by you guys?
Sure. Well, basically, they can just give us a call via our numbers, which is 667-3115 or 299-3115. Or they can even visit our social media pages. So we do respond via the WhatsApp as well as Instagram. Or they can even drop by within our office if they are within the AREMA vicinity. Mm-hmm. They can pay us a visit and they can book the eye examination, the OCT examination, and then we'll be able to proceed from there.
Okay. And is there anything the patients need to prepare beforehand when doing an OCT scan? Is there any specific instructions they need to follow?
Yes. So actually, before doing the scans, we usually put some drops in the eyes. So these drops are called dilating drops. So it actually temporarily relaxes the muscles in the eyes so that we can get a better scan of the back of your eyes. Now, this makes your vision a bit blurry for a few hours. So driving becomes a little bit more difficult. Seeing things close up is a little bit more difficult as well. So you should come with someone, or if you're driving, you'll probably have to wait a little while for the eyes to clear up a bit, about 3 hours or so. And also you should walk with a pair of sunglasses because the lights will really be bothering you outside.
Okay, great. So that is what a patient should do beforehand. They need to organize, you know, drops, etc. And are there any additional tests or procedures that may be recommended based on the findings of the OCT scan?
So yes, it depends. So like, for example, in a patient that might have been diagnosed with glaucoma or has a family history of glaucoma, it is definitely recommend, besides the OCT scan, they should have a visual field test done. Now, depending on if there's a macular issue at the back of the eye, we can do such tests as the Amsler grid, etc. Also with glaucoma, we can actually do something called a pachymetry. Now, that's very, very important because it actually detects and actually monitors, as well as take a look at the thickness of the cornea, which is very, very important when we take a look at the eye pressures. So like, for example, it all depends on the condition that they might have been diagnosed with by the ophthalmologist, mm-hmm. or have been suspected with. So we work in hand with the ophthalmologist, and they would be able to recommend, you know, they would say, okay, well, we like to have this test done. So we do get referrals from the hospitals as well as private ophthalmologists. And then we just go accordingly from there.
Okay, great. And is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know when it comes to OCT scans?
So if you're someone who's unsure about your family history or unsure about anything with your eyes, the key thing is to get your eyes checked regularly. So ideally, it should be every 2 years. Now, you might be suggested, they might suggest 1 year for you if you have diabetes or if you're over 60, right? So the key thing is to get your eyes checked, and the optometrist will be able to detect any early signs. So if the optic nerve looks a little strange, we'll suggest the OCT. If the pressure is a little high, we'll suggest the OCT. Yeah.
Okay, great.
So in reality, the OCT scan really picks up any abnormalities in the eye. In a routine eye examination, you know, we can see into the back of the eye, but with the OCT scan, it actually reveals what's happening at a deeper level in the retinal nerve fiber layer level, which means that it's easier to detect conditions at a much earlier stage that cannot easily be detected otherwise. Also with the OCT scan, you know, when we actually do complete an OCT scan, we can show the patient the images, and it's a great visual for patients to see actually what is happening with their eyes. So therefore, if there is a problem and there is a bit of a shift where things are not going so well, then it's better to explain to patients that there is a bit of a problem, and therefore we might have better compliance with managements and treatments of any conditions that might be happening for the patient. So it's really a great tool for educating the patient, and also obviously for us for picking up things at an earlier stage.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So there are so many benefits to this OCT scan, and of course everybody should get their eyes checked regularly. And especially if you have risk factors like diabetes, high blood pressure. So thank you guys for coming on, explaining what the OCT scan is, the benefits, and who should get it, and how they should be prepared for such a scan. So thank you very much for enlightening us today.
Thank you for having us. We actually want to let our listeners know mm-hmm. that we have a special for the month of April. So our regular price for the OCT scan is $400, But just for the month of April, we have a 2-for-1 special. So they're getting an eye examination as well as an OCT scan for only $340. So it's actually a win-win situation. It's very, very good. So any patients who wants to get their scan done along with an eye examination, it's highly, highly recommended for them to do so.
Okay, great. And I think our listeners will take that into consideration.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Of course, you've been listening to a segment there with the kind compliments of Dalton, Brong and Associates right here on the Lunchtime Doctor. Make sure to check them out. We take another break again and we come right back. All right, folks, we're back at it with the Lunchtime Doctor. Of course, you could WhatsApp us at 3061065. We're talking about some myths. What about people who swear by apple cider vinegar in the morning? Every morning. Wow. They all laugh. But
is it good for
me? I mean, is it good?
So, in terms of the research and the data, what it does is it can actually help decrease the insulin spike. And in the aim of that, kind of trying to reduce your fat or weight loss. So that is the main thing. But at the end of the day, if you're not taking a balanced diet and restricting calories, etc., it's not going to really do anything much. There's also suggestion that it can help detox or cleanse the liver. We don't have any hard data to support that.
Right. And while we're on the topic of, you know, losing fat, etc., I know there are some people who have this notion that eating before bed, or rather not eating before bedtime, will help them lose weight. Now, what are your thoughts on this?
So meal timing in general does not have any relation when it comes to weight loss. Weight loss is primarily thermodynamics, which means calories in versus calories out. If you are expending more calories than you are consuming, you will lose weight.
And exactly. That's it. So you need to be in a caloric deficit, essentially.
So it's okay to eat and then go and sleep?
Well, I mean, in terms of your general lifestyle, it depends on what your goal is. There's nothing to say, well, okay, if I eat before bed, that something bad is going to happen. However, you don't want to eat too close to bed. Reason being is because of your gastrointestinal system being active. It may prevent proper sleep, right? Or restful sleep. That's one. Two, if you have other conditions like reflux, etc., you definitely don't want to eat too close to bedtime. But in terms of weight loss,
there's no actual consideration when it comes to weight loss. And another thing about weight loss, a lot of people tend to assume that if you want to lose fat, you need to stop consuming fat or fat-derived products. So what are the actual facts about consuming fat and losing fat?
Now, that stems from the fact that 1 gram of fat is 9 calories compared to protein and carbs, which is 4 calories per gram. So thereby, okay, it's more. But that's actually, it's not that relevant when it comes to restricting calories, and the same law of thermodynamics where calories in versus calories out, once you are expending more than you consume, there's no, for example, there are patients who are in this keto diet, right, where they eat pure fats, no carbs. They lose a tremendous amount of weight because with carbs, carbs carry water. You understand? So there are many different things to take away. But the most important thing is restricting fats is not healthy, right? Because we have things like polyunsaturated fats. These things are good for promoting heart health and for, you know, the building of your steroid hormones, which will affect your metabolism. So there's no recommendation to...
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, your calories will be dependent on your goal. For example, if you are looking to build muscle, your calories need to be primarily from protein sources. right? Mm-hmm. And I would agree, you know, restricting fats is not going to have that much of an effect on somebody who wants to lose weight.
Yeah.
I would say that maybe having a restriction on refined carbs or refined
that is way
sugars
more beneficial.
When you say refined, what do you mean, like bread and flour?
So these things are like processed sugars and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, this myth has been going on for years.
Mm-hmm.
Low fat milk mm-hmm. and all these different things. It's a fallacy. You know?
I do have a question here.
Good afternoon, Doc. Is it possible that insulin can cause it to gain weight?
Ah, excellent. Now, in vitro, which means when the baby is in the womb, mm-hmm. insulin is actually the primary growth factor, mm-hmm. right? So it's a growth hormone. Insulin can make you put on weight, most definitely.
Right.
That's it.
So that's the fact there. Insulin can make you put on weight. And, you know, just to add to what Dr. Taylor is saying here, you know, when the baby is in the womb and the mother actually has diabetes, insulin makes the baby grow much bigger mm-hmm. than what the baby is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So you get these very big babies being born to diabetic mothers, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, insulin does have that effect on babies and even, you know, full-grown adults. So taking exogenous or insulin that is not created within the body can make you put on weight.
Right, so that means if you are diabetic and you are on insulin, you need to even watch your...
Exactly.
Yes, you need to watch your diet a lot more.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right, speaking about the eyesight, is it a food myth that eating carrots will improve your eyesight? Plus, is there any truth in that eating raw carrots is better than cooked carrots? I eat a lot of raw carrots. And
so,
I still wear glasses.
I mean, I think the thing with cooked vegetables is mm-hmm. that you want to take out any pathogens mm-hmm. from any of the vegetables. So you don't know what pesticides, etc., that they've used on it. Of course, you may wash it, but of course, cooking it will be give it a higher temperature, and that, of course, will kill a lot of pathogens. So that mm-hmm. will answer that question there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cooking it may be better and may be more beneficial when you're looking for a healthier way of eating the foods.
Mm-hmm.
Now, vitamin A is found in carrots, and vitamin A is also very good for your eyesight. The amount of vitamin A that is contained in a carrot may not be the amount that is beneficial to your eyesight. So you're going to need to eat a copious amount of carrots to get that, you know, that effect. So it is a myth, you know, eating carrots is good. I mean, it is a good vegetable to have daily. You can eat carrots, but I would say that eating carrots to benefit your eyesight, you're going to have to eat a very large amount of carrots to get that benefit.
Mm-hmm. What about in terms of vegetables on the whole and with all the chemicals that are on it, you know, these days? What is the factor?
Yeah, you know, that's a very good question. But unfortunately, like in life, we are bombarded by processed things, highly fertilized and pesticide, weedicide, all these different things mm-hmm. are surround us everywhere. I think the best approach is you alternate the types of foods you eat.
Mm-hmm.
So 1 week you consume spinach, next week kale, next week maybe pak choy. You know, you alternate the type of foods you eat, so you never overdose on something bad, because mm-hmm. you know, different foods come from different places. You have things like heavy mercury poisoning, all these different things. So you have to just alternate. That's the solution. Alternate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. Of course, 5 minutes away from 1 o'clock, we're inside of the lunchtime doctor. 627-322-3625-2257. And of course, we're on Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangeet 106.1, and Sky 99.5. Right.
So one more myth that, you know, I want to bring to light, because I do get this in my practice sometimes. I would have patients who have the flu or the cold and they come asking for antibiotics.
Mm.
Now, does antibiotics work for the flu or influenza?
Short answer, no. N-O, it does not.
Right. And this is because antibiotics work against bacteria or bacteria-induced infections. And the flu is caused by the influenza virus. So antibiotics will not be beneficial against viruses.
Now, the caveat is there are certain situations, specifically in cases where people are immunocompromised, there is the ability to have a viral infection and what we call a superimposed bacterial infection. So what you would see is children, for example, with the flu, etc., they may get antibiotics, especially if they end up in the hospital. The reason is because they could also contract a bacterial infection way easier than a middle-aged person. And also the same is true for elderly people as well. They may get what we call broad-spectrum antibiotics to cover the potential for a bacterial superimposed infection.
And now that we're on the topic of antibiotics, you know, a lot of people know that penicillin is usually one of the main antibiotics that we will prescribe to patients who are going home, etc. And if you're not allergic to penicillin, are you not allergic to any antibiotic?
No, the answer that is false, because there are many antibiotics that are not penicillin-based. So it's important for your doctor to know that they are allergic to penicillin. Therefore, the doctor would definitely not prescribe penicillin unless, I mean, they have to. But generally speaking, they won't.
Yeah, because, I mean, antibiotics can span so many different levels. You know, there are different antibiotics for different bacteria. And being allergic to penicillin does not mean that you are allergic to another antibiotic. And that's why it's important, you know, that you need to disclose this information to your doctor if you're allergic to penicillin. Because you can just easily be switched to another antibiotic. Right. So are there any other myths that is pressing on your mind?
Well, finally, one myth I have is that there are some patients who say that, you know, I'm not going to the hospital because John went to the hospital and as soon as he went to the hospital, he died. Right? Now, I want people to think about that. And maybe it is that John has had a disease that has been festering for months and he presented to the hospital in extremis, meaning he couldn't cope with it anymore. And clearly he has gone with this thing for way too long. And as soon as he got to the hospital, it was too late. Nothing could be done for him. I think that is very important because I hear this a lot. There are a lot of patients who come and, you know, this is the excuse. They see their friend or their cousin go to the hospital and they die as soon as they get there or within a few hours. But it's 99.9% unrelated to what has happened at the hospital, but what has been happening to the patient over the span of time.
So it is important to get your regular checkups, even if you think something may not be as bothersome as you may think it is. It is important to go to your doctor regularly, get your regular checkups, check your blood pressure, your blood sugar, all these things, because you may not even know that you have this diagnosis of diabetes or have this diagnosis of high blood pressure until something happens or some one of the complications, you know, presents itself. So your health is your wealth, of course, and make sure that you are taking care of yourself, you're eating healthy, you are doing, you know, your daily activities, your size, etc., and visit your doctor if you have any concerns.
All right, so we wrap up our lunchtime, doctor, for today. We save more of the questions that were coming in later on for tomorrow. Once again, thanks to our Dalton Brong, an optometrist there, and indeed LSA Healthcare Services, and of course our friends out there, GNC Total Lean. Catch you tomorrow. Of course, many thanks to our friends out there listening on Sky 99.5 FM and Sangeet 106.1. Do enjoy the rest of your day.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.